Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Ozone is a big factor in global warming. A new study led by University of Reading found ozone could be the second largest contributor to future warming by 2050. Ironically, efforts to restore the protective ozone layer may add to the climate shift. Let's investigate with lead author William J. Collins, professor of climate processes at University of Reading. He's been working and publishing on this sticky problem for 20 years. From Reading, UK, Bill Collins, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What is ozone? Could we see it in a jar?
Ozone is a gas in the atmosphere that's not very, certainly down at our level, is not very prevalent. It's a few parts per billion. That may not sound very much, but it can have important consequences for health and for climate. There's a bit more of it in the stratosphere when it can reach a few parts per million. Again, parts per million doesn't sound very much, but those parts per million in the stratosphere are enough to protect us from the worst radiation from the sun.
Is ozone a greenhouse gas in itself?
Yes, it is, yes. So greenhouse gases act by trapping the heat given off in the form of infrared radiation by the Earth. And ozone is very effective at trapping that heat. So yes, it acts as a greenhouse gas, both down at the troposphere, our level, and up in the stratosphere as well.
From the human perspective, ozone has two faces. In the upper atmosphere, it helps prevent cancer by shielding ultraviolet rays from the sun. Here on the ground, ozone is part of the smog that kills millions of people a year. So there's good ozone and bad ozone?
Yes, that's the way some people like to talk about it. I mean, I guess from a chemistry point of view, we just call it ozone. But yes, you're absolutely right. It's toxic to people and to plants as well. So not only does it mean that, we shouldn't breathe it, but it can actually damage crops and reduce crop productivity. So we've taken lots of steps over the last few decades, ever since it was identified really in Los Angeles that we were producing it down at ground level. So we've taken steps, or many countries have taken steps to reduce the pollutants that produce ozone. However, quite the opposite is true in the stratosphere. I mean, we wouldn't like to be up in the stratosphere breathing it, but so long as it's away from us, it's protecting us, as you said, from the ultraviolet rays from the sun, which would be very damaging both to us and to wildlife and to vegetation as well. So too much ultraviolet light would be hugely detrimental. And saving the ozone layer has been one of the big environmental success stories of recent decades. So countries around the world signed a protocol called the Montreal Protocol back in the 1990s. And that's been probably the most successful global agreement on environmental legislation we've ever had.
Yes, we hope that upper ozone level will recover and the ozone hole over Antarctica in particular will replenish itself. But you say that could contribute to more warming. How does that work?
Yes, well, as we were discussing earlier, ozone is a greenhouse gas, and it's also greenhouse gas even when it's up in the stratosphere, 20 kilometers high. So we definitely want that ozone to recover, because we would have severe environmental consequences if it didn't recover. But we pay a bit of a penalty in terms of the climate effect, because it's a greenhouse gas. This recovery will end up warming the Earth. There's a sort of a slight analogy here with ground level pollutants called aerosols. So these are particles that are very noxious to breathe in, and we don't want to, but they cool the climate. So we've taken strong action to remove particularly sulfur from fuels and so on, which has been good for health, but actually harmed increased global warming. But we've taken the viewpoint that actually direct damage to human health is more important to solve, and that we should maybe address the global warming issue.
Aerosol pollution does not actually add to the amount of warming by our emissions. I mean, smog stops the true energy imbalance from greenhouse gases from appearing. It cools us somewhat. Is that true of the upper level ozone? I mean, if ozone manages to refill that hole, is it actually adding to warming, or is it revealing heating caused by other sources?
Yes, I guess you could argue that way. Whichever way it is, the world will be warmer if the ozone hole. But I think in terms of the lesser evil, it's more important for the ozone hole to recover and for us to address the climate problem through, as I said, we don't want to make the ozone hole worse just from a climate point of view, because that would be so damaging to the environment.
So the oxygen that we breathe has two atoms in it, and the ozone has three. And it is fascinating how three oxygen molecules get joined up. Tell us about the Chapman cycle.
So what happens is, high up in the atmosphere, when we get lots of ultraviolet radiation from the sun, that's strong enough to break up oxygen molecules. So oxygen, as you said, is O2, and if the sunlight can split that actually into two single oxygen atoms. So high up in the stratosphere, we have oxygen atoms, single atoms flying around. And if they hit another oxygen molecule, they can add on to it. So we go from an O2 to an O3, and that's how ozone is formed high in the stratosphere. So that's the basic formula for why we have the stratospheric ozone layer.
I did not know that ground-level ozone can also add to warming. How does that happen?
As with other greenhouse gases, ozone traps the heat that's given off by the Earth. So this is in the form of, we call it thermal infrared radiation, and that radiation is just in the wavelength that ozone and other greenhouse gases can absorb. And we often refer to it as the greenhouse effect, but I think it's more useful to call it a blanket effect. Effectively, we're just stopping the heat given off from the Earth escaping as much as it would if you wrapped a blanket around yourself.
Is the contribution of ground-level ozone to warming relatively small or significant?
I think it's reasonably significant. I mean, I'm particularly interested in ozone. It's something I've been studying for 30 years. So I guess I am going to say it's significant. And I've generally been in institutions that have been very focused on climate and carbon dioxide. And I'm always shouting at them, please remember ozone as well. It's important to include ozone in all our climate projections. So, I think ozone has generally been neglected as a climate gas when it is pretty important. Probably about the third most important greenhouse gas. So carbon dioxide is obviously by far the most dominant, and then comes methane, and then ozone is the third most important gas.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
It is strange. With all the conversations I've had with scientists, ozone very seldom comes up. Has it been included in the IPCC models?
Yes, it has, and I've been responsible for building some of those models or running some of those models. So I've made sure that certainly it's something that's addressed and assessed and calculated. But I think it still deserves more attention than it should. It's often regarded as a bit of an add-on that they're slightly unwilling to put in or put in under process because of bullying from us atmospheric chemists saying you mustn't forget ozone. But hopefully with this paper it'll become much more obvious to people that it's something that should be really treated very seriously in these climate models and given the full consideration.
So, Bill Collins, when your team adds up all the ways ozone high and low adds to warming, what is the total effect? Can we get a measurement out of that?
Well, so we report these things in a slightly obscure term called the radiative forcing, which is basically how much energy the gas is trapped. And we recalculated this value using these up-to-date models, and particularly a rather new method of calculating this radiative forcing that accounts for all the meteorological changes that happen as well. And we came up with a number that's 0.27 watts per meter squared, and that probably won't mean much to many people, but the previous number in the IPCC going out to 2050 was 0.19. So we've showed it's significantly larger than was estimated in the latest IPCC report. However, if we're comparing this to carbon dioxide, then that's now close to 2 watts per meter squared. So, you know, we're nothing like as, ozone is nothing like as important as carbon dioxide. And as we were saying about healing the ozone hole, really, yes, we should be worried that it makes reducing global warming more difficult, but carbon dioxide is by far the most important greenhouse gas. And so whatever we do, we just need to keep reducing carbon dioxide as well. The reason for the ozone forcing, part of it was because of recovery of the ozone layer, so that's a bit of a trade-off. But of course, as we were talking, the ozone pollution at ground level is both damaging and warming. So we can actually take strong steps to reduce the amount of climate warming from ozone if we reduced our ground level pollution. And not our study, but similar studies with similar models that I was indeed involved with have shown that if we really put stringent efforts in to clean up pollution, the amount of ozone we can reduce at the surface actually outweighs the greenhouse contribution from the recovery in the stratosphere. So we can actually turn ozone into a good news story if we really focus on reducing ground level pollution.
So does that ground-level ozone eventually drift up into the stratosphere, or is the formation of stratospheric ozone a completely different setup?
It's actually the other way around. So stratospheric ozone wends its way down to the troposphere because it's so there's so much more of it in the stratosphere. I said something like 2 parts per million as opposed to a few tens of parts per billion down in the troposphere. So it was thought for a long time, actually, that most of the ozone we see at ground level came from the stratosphere. I said it was only research in Los Angeles smogs in the 1950s when we realized we were actually making a lot of it ourselves. But and another question people have had in the past is, could we solve the ozone hole by pushing up our ground level ozone into the stratosphere? And the answer is unfortunately no, because it's so much more concentrated in the stratosphere that even if we could somehow direct air from the ground level up into the stratosphere, it's not concentrated enough to help mend the ozone hole.
One of the big unknowns in models and in our future is cloud formation. More clouds cool the Earth, of course, with their shade. Does ozone influence cloud formation, and is that ozone stratospheric or ground level?
So that's actually what our study found, and it's probably the first time really anyone's looked at this in any level of detail. We found actually that both stratospheric and ground level ozone reduce the amount of clouds. So that can indeed, that would increase the amount of warming because it would let more sunlight in towards the Earth's surface. But actually, clouds themselves can also act in a bit like the greenhouse effect. So not only do they stop sunlight coming in, but they trap the heat going out. That's actually why the coldest days are usually the clearest days. A cloudy day really doesn't ever get as cold as a clear day because the clouds themselves act as a blanket. And it turns out that the highest level clouds, so, round about sort of 10 kilometers or something, can act, they're actually have a stronger effect as a blanket, as effectively another greenhouse gas, than they do in blocking the sunlight from reaching the Earth. So you might think that clouds always cool the climate, but they can certainly, in high clouds can warm the climate as well.
So I assume we don't have a reliable way to measure ozone levels in pre-industrial times, and if so, that would make it hard to know where we're going. How did your team deal with that problem in this new study?
So we particularly didn't look at the pre-industrial level. So that's something that past studies have focused a lot on, what's the change in ozone between the 1850s and the present day, was we were much more looking at the future changes in ozone, where we certainly have good measurements of present day ozone. So that was one way, or particularly that meant our study didn't need to consider that we don't really have good measurements of pre-industrial ozone.
Your study assumed the shared socioeconomic pathway SSP3-7 scenario from the IPCC that would make Earth over 3 degrees C hotter than pre-industrial by end of century, and it is the direction we're going in right now. And the scenario includes continuing high aerosol pollution. What if public pressure forces governments to really clean up the air? Would that change predictions for ozone changes and ozone-forced warming?
Oh, absolutely. It's this polluted scenario because I wanted to see what would be the impact of increased levels of pollution. But absolutely, we hope we're not going down that trend at all. In earlier studies, have looked at the effect of cleaning up pollution, and that shows a really important effect. So, absolutely, if we take strong action to clean up pollutants, and these pollutants are particularly oxides of nitrogen and hydrocarbons, which come out of things like vehicle exhaust or power station chimneys and so on. Hopefully, countries will have an important effect on reducing ground level ozone. So that's an important health benefit, but will also give you the climate benefit as well.
We've been publishing about ozone and warming and atmospheric chemistry since 2006. In that year, you co-authored the paper Radiative Forcing Since Pre-Industrial Times Due to Ozone Change in the Troposphere and the Lower Stratosphere. What are the major lessons learned on this subject in the last 20 years or so?
So I would say that this particular study, as I said, it incorporated a lot more of the meteorological effects of ozone. So those past studies, we had to calculate the climate effect in a separate model to the one that we were calculating the ozone in, whereas in the most recent study, we used climate models with chemistry embedded. And so because we had the same model doing the climate and the chemistry, we could investigate the effect of the ozone on the clouds and on the amount of water vapor and on the different temperatures at different levels in the atmosphere as well. So doing this much more complete calculation, including all these meteorological factors, I think has given us a really good new understanding of the impact of ozone on climate.
In 2005, the UK government led a conference called Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change, and in that conference they talked about a safety limit of around 400 parts per million or so CO2, and now here we are 20 years later and we're past that, well past, we're up at 425 at least. Does that mean that it's getting too late to avoid dangerous climate change?
No, it doesn't. It certainly doesn't from a physical climate point of view. We've shown, and one of the biggest, I think, advances in climate science, that if we could stop the emissions of carbon dioxide, that would actually stop the warming. So we're not ever on physical. So we can take action and we can reduce, we can stop the further warming. So it's really a political question. So I think perhaps your question should be maybe put to a politician as whether they have the political will to stop emitting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
As we wrap up here, are there ozone mysteries still to crack? What are you working on?
So interesting do in this study. So we separated the effect of these ozone-depleting substances, chlorofluorocarbons and so on, but identify which pollutants were responsible for the changes in the ground-level ozone. As I said, these are a mixture of oxides of nitrogen and various different hydrocarbons. So a study that we are just, in fact, the reason that I'm in a hotel is because I'm at a conference and today we were discussing how we were going to assess these different hydrocarbons and run experiments to calculate what impact each individual hydrocarbon has. So that's where we're going next. And that will provide quite valuable policy information because we say, oh, we must reduce the pollutants to produce ozone. Then the policymaker could say, well, which particular pollutants are most effective? You know, should we address first? Which ones should we target? to have the best effect in reducing ground level ozone. So we are just planning some model experiments that would address exactly that question.
From the University of Reading, we've been speaking with William J. Collins, Professor of Climate Processes. He is lead author in the paper titled Climate Forcing Due to Future Ozone Changes, an Intercomparison of Metrics and Methods. That is an open access paper. You can look at it yourself and find out quite a bit. Find links and more notes in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Bill, thank you for sharing this new science with us.
It's been my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. For Radio EcoShock.